How had I put this out of mind? How could I have been so cruel? The guilt for what I'd done burned worse than any ghoul scratch. Tarquin shifted on his throne. He tried for a laugh, but the sound came out more like a bark of alarm.
You must be insane, woman. Your original price would have bankrupted my kingdom, and that was when you had 9 books. You burned 3 of them, and now you come back to offer me only 6, for the same exorbitant sum.
The woman held out the books, one hand on top as if preparing to say an oath.
Knowledge is expensive, King of Rome. The less there is, the more it is worth. Be glad I am not charging you double.
Oh, I see. I should be grateful then.
The king looked at his captive audience of senators for support. That was their cue to laugh and jeer at the woman. None did. They looked more afraid of the Sibyl than of the king.
I expect no gratitude from the likes of you,
the Sibyl rasped.
But you should act in your own self-interest, and in the interest of your kingdom. I offer knowledge of the future, how to avert disaster, how to summon the help of the gods, how to make Rome a great empire. All that knowledge is here. At least 6 volumes of it remain.
Ridiculous, snapped the king. I should have you executed for your disrespect.
If only that were possible.
The Sibyl's voice was as bitter and calm as an Arctic morning.
Do you refuse my offer, then?
I am High Priest as well as King, cried Tarquin. Only I decide how to appease the gods. I don't need...
The Sibyl took the top 3 books off the stack and casually threw them into the nearest brazier. The volumes blazed immediately, as if they'd been written in kerosene on sheets of rice paper. In a single great roar, they were gone. The guards gripped their spears. The senators muttered and shifted on their seats. Perhaps they could feel what I could feel. A cosmic sigh of anguish. The exhale of destiny, as so many volumes of prophetic knowledge vanished from the world, casting a shadow across the future, plunging generations into darkness. How could the Sibyl do it? Why? Perhaps it was her way of taking revenge on me. I'd criticized her for writing so many volumes, for not letting me oversee her work. But by the time she wrote the Sibylline books, I had been angry at her for different reasons. My curse had already been set. Our relationship was beyond repair. By burning her own books, she was spitting on my criticism, on the prophetic gift I had given her, and on the too high price she had paid to be my Sibyl. Or perhaps she was motivated by something other than bitterness. Perhaps she had a reason for challenging Tarquin, as she did, and exacting such a high penalty for his stubbornness.
Last chance, she told the king. I offer you 3 books of prophecy for the same price as before.
For the same?
The king choked on his rage. I could see how much he wanted to refuse. He wanted to scream obscenities at the Sibyl and order his guards to impale her on the spot. But his senators were shifting and whispering uneasily. His guards' faces were pale with fear. His enslaved women were doing their best to hide behind the dais. Romans were a superstitious people. Tarquin knew this. As high priest, he was responsible for protecting his subjects by interceding with the gods. Under no circumstances was he supposed to make the gods angry. This old woman was offering him prophetic knowledge to help his kingdom. The crowd in the throne room could sense her power, her closeness to the divine. If Tarquin allowed her to burn those last books, if he threw away her offer, it might not be the Sybil whom his guards decided to impale.
Well,
the Sybil prompted, holding her three remaining volumes close to the flames. Tarquin swallowed back his anger. Through clenched teeth, he forced out the words,
I agree to your terms.
Good,
said the Sybil, no visible relief or disappointment on her face.
Let payment be brought to the Pomerian line. Once I have it, you will have the books.
The Sybil disappeared in a flash of blue light. My dream dissolved with her. Put on your sheet. Meg threw a toga in my face, which was not the nicest way to be woken up. I blinked, still groggy, the smell of smoke, moldy straw, and sweaty Romans lingering in my nostrils. A toga? But I'm not a senator. You're honorary, because you used to be a god or whatever. Meg pouted. I don't get to wear a sheet. I had a horrible mental image of Meg in a traffic light colored toga, gardening seeds spilling from the folds of the cloth. She would just have to make do with her glittery unicorn t-shirt. Bombilo gave me his usual good morning glare when I came downstairs to appropriate the cafe bathroom. I washed up, then changed my bandages with a kit the healers had thoughtfully left in our room. The ghoul scratch looked no worse, but it was still puckered and angry red. It still burned. That was normal, right? I tried to convince myself it was. As they say, doctor gods make the worst patient gods. I got dressed, trying to remember how to fold a toga, and mulled over the things I'd learned from my dream. Number one, I was a terrible person who ruined lives. Number two, there was not a single bad thing I'd done in the last 4,000 years that was not going to come back and bite me in the clunis. And I was beginning to think I deserved it. The Cumaean Sybil. Oh, Apollo, what had you been thinking? Alas, I knew what I'd been thinking. That she was a pretty young woman I wanted to get with, despite the fact that she was my Sybil. Then she'd outsmarted me, and being the bad loser that I was, I had cursed her. No wonder I was now paying the price. Tracking down the evil Roman king to whom she'd once sold her Sibylline books. If Tarquin was still clinging to some horrible undead existence, could the Cumaean Sybil be alive as well? I shuddered to think what she might be like after all these centuries, and how much her hatred for me would have grown. First things first, I had to tell the Senate my marvelous plan to make things right and save us all. Did I have a marvelous plan? Shockingly, maybe. Or at least the beginnings of a marvelous plan. The marvelous index of one. On our way out, Meg and I grabbed Lemurian spice lattes and a couple of blueberry muffins, because Meg clearly needed more sugar and caffeine. Then we joined the loose procession of demigods heading for the city. By the time we got to the Senate House, everyone was taking their seats. Flanking the rostrum, Praetors Reina and Frank were arrayed in their finest gold and purple. The first row of benches was occupied by the camp's 10 senators, each in a white toga trimmed in purple. Along with the senior-most veterans, those with accessibility needs, and Ella and Tyson. Ella fidgeted, doing her best to avoid brushing shoulders with the senator on her left. Tyson grinned at the Lar on his right, wriggling his fingers inside the ghost's vaporous rib cage. Behind them, the semicircle of tiered seats was packed to overflowing with legionnaires, Larrys, retired veterans, and other citizens of New Rome. I hadn't seen a lecture hall this crowded since Charles Dickens's 1867 Second American Tour, great show. I still have the autographed t-shirt framed in my bedroom in the Palace of the Sun.
I thought I should sit in front, being an honorary wearer of bed linens, but there was simply no room.
Then I spotted Lavinia, thank you, pink hair, waving at us from the back row. She patted the bench next to her, indicating that she'd saved us seats, a thoughtful gesture. Or maybe she wanted something. Once Meg and I had settled on either side of her, Lavinia gave Meg the super-secret unicorn sisterhood fist bump, then turned and ribbed me with her sharp elbow. So you're really Apollo after all. You must know my mom. What? Her eyebrows were extra distracting today. The dark roots had started to grow out under the pink dye, which made them seem to hover slightly off-center, as if they were about to float off her face. My mom? She repeated, popping her bubblegum.
Terpsichore?
The muse of dance.
Are you asking me if she's your mother or if I know her?
Of course she's my mother.
Of course I know her.
Well then. Lavinia drummed a riff on her knees, as if to prove she had a dancer's rhythm, despite being so gangly. I want to hear the dirt.
The dirt?
I've never met her.
Over the centuries, I'd had many conversations with demigods who wanted to know more about their absentee godly parents. Those talks rarely went well. I tried to conjure a picture of Terpsichore, but my memories of Olympus were getting fuzzier by the day. I vaguely recalled the muse frolicking around one of the parks on Mount Olympus, casting rose petals in her wake as she twirled and pirouetted. Truth be told, Terpsichore had never been my favorite of the nine muses.
She tended to take the spotlight off me, where it rightly belonged.
She had your color hair, I ventured.
Pink?
No, I mean, dark. Lots of nervous energy, I suppose, like you.
She was never happy unless she was moving, but
my voice died. What could I say that wouldn't sound mean? Terpsichore was graceful and poised and didn't look like a wobbly giraffe. Was Lavinia sure there hadn't been some mistake about her parentage? Because I couldn't believe they were related.
But what? She pressed.
Nothing. Hard to remember. Down at the rostrum, Reyna was calling the meeting to order. Everyone, if you'll please take your seats. We need to get started. Dakota, can you scoot in a little to make room for... Thanks. Lavinia regarded me skeptically.
That's the lamest dirt ever. If you can't tell me about my mom, at least tell me what's going on with you and Ms. Praetor down there.
I squirmed. The bench suddenly felt a great deal harder under my clueness. There's nothing to tell.
Oh, please. The way you've been sneaking glances at Reyna since you got here. I noticed it. Meg noticed.
I noticed,
Meg confirmed. Even Frank Zhang noticed. Lavinia turned up her palms as if she'd just provided the ultimate proof of complete obviousness. Reyna began to address the crowd.
Senators, guests, we have called this emergency meeting to discuss...
Honestly,
I whispered to Lavinia. It's awkward. You wouldn't understand. She snorted.
Awkward is telling your rabbi that Daniela Bernstein is going to be your date for your bat mitzvah party.
Or telling your dad that the only dancing you want to do is tap, so you're not going to carry on the Asimov family tradition. I know all about awkward. Reyna continued.
In light of Jason Grace's ultimate sacrifice and our own recent battle against the undead, we have to take very seriously the threat.
Wait.
I whispered to Lavinia, her words sinking in.
Your dad is Sergei Asimov,
The dancer. The... I stopped myself before I could say the smoking hot Russian ballet star, but judging from Lavinia's eye roll, she knew what I was thinking.
Yeah, yeah, she said. Stop trying to change the subject. Are you going to dish on...
Lavinia Asimov, Raina called from the rostrum. Did you have something to say?
All eyes turned toward us. A few legionnaires smirked, as if this was not the first time Lavinia had been called out during a Senate meeting. Lavinia glanced from side to side, then pointed to herself, as if unsure which of the many Lavinia Asimovs Raina might be addressing.
No, ma'am. I'm good.
Raina did not look amused by being called ma'am.
I notice you're chewing gum as well. Did you bring enough for the whole Senate?
Lavinia pulled multiple packs of gum from her pockets. She scanned the crowd, doing a quick guesstimate.
Maybe?
Raina glanced heavenward, as if asking the gods, why do I have to be the only adult in the room?
I'll assume, the praetor said, that you are just trying to draw attention to the guest seated next to you, who has important information to share. Lester Papadopoulos, rise and address the Senate.
Chapter 12. I now have a plan. To make a plan concerning the plan for my plan. Normally, when I'm about to perform, I wait backstage. Once I'm announced and the crowd is frenzied with anticipation, I burst through the curtains, the spotlights hit me, and ta-da! I am a god.
Raina's introduction did not inspire wild applause.
Lester Papadopoulos, rise and address the Senate, was about as exciting as, we will now have a PowerPoint about adverbs. As soon as I started making my way to the aisle, Lavinia tripped me. I glared back at her. She gave me an innocent face, like her foot just happened to be there. Given the size of her legs, maybe it had been. Everyone watched as I fumbled my way through the crowd, trying not to trip on my toga. Excuse me, sorry, excuse me. By the time I made it to the rostrum, the audience was whipped into a frenzy of boredom and impatience. No doubt they would have all been checking their phones, except demigods couldn't use smartphones without risking monster attack. So they had no alternative but to stare at me. I had wowed them 2 days ago with a fantastic musical tribute to Jason Grace, but what had I done for them lately? Only the Larrys looked content to wait. They could endure sitting on hard benches forever. From the back row, Meg waved at me. Her expression was less like, "Hi, you'll do great," and more like, "Get on with it." I turned my gaze to Tyson, who was grinning at me from the front row. When you find yourself focusing on the Cyclops in the crowd for moral support, you know you're going to bomb. So, hi. Great start. I hoped another burst of inspiration might lead to a follow-up song. Nothing happened. I'd left my ukulele in my room, sure that if I'd tried to bring it into the city, Terminus would have confiscated it as a weapon. I have some bad news, I said, and some bad news. Which do you want to hear first? The crowd exchanged apprehensive looks. Lavinia yelled, "Start with the bad news. That's always best."
"Hey," Frank chastised her. "Like decorum, you know?"
Having restored solemnity to the Senate meeting, Frank gestured for me to proceed. "The Emperors Commodus and Caligula have combined forces," I said. I described what I'd seen in my dream. "They're sailing toward us right now with a fleet of 50 yachts.
all equipped with some kind of terrible new weapon. They'll be here by the Blood Moon, which, as I understand it, is in 3 days, April 8th, which also happens to be Laster Papadopoulos' birthday.
Happy birthday,
Tyson said. Thanks. Also, I'm not sure what a Blood Moon is. A hand shot up in the second row. Go ahead, Ida, Raina said, then added for my benefit. Centurion of the second cohort, Legacy of Luna. Seriously? I didn't mean to sound incredulous, but Luna, a Titan, had been in charge of the moon before my sister Artemis took over the job. As far as I knew, Luna had faded away millennia ago. Then again, I'd thought there was nothing left of Helios, the Sun Titan, until I found out that Medea was collecting shreds of his consciousness to heat the burning maze. Those Titans were like my acne. They just kept popping up. The Centurion stood, scowling. Yes, seriously. A Blood Moon is a full moon that looks red because there's a full lunar eclipse. It's a bad time to fight the undead. They're especially powerful on those nights. Actually, Ella stood, picking at her finger talons. Actually, the color is caused by the dispersal of reflected light from the sunrise and sunset of Earth. A true blood moon refers to 4 lunar eclipses in a row. The next one is on April 8th. Yep, Farmer's Almanac, Moon Phase Calendar Supplemental. She plopped down again, leaving the audience in stunned silence. Nothing is quite so disconcerting as having science explained to you by a supernatural creature. Thank you, Ida and Ella, Raina said. Lester, did you have more to add? Her tone suggested that it would be totally okay if I didn't, since I'd already shared enough information to cause a camp-wide panic. I'm afraid so, I said. The Emperors have allied themselves with Tarquin the Proud. The Larrys in the room guttered and flickered.
Impossible, cried one.
Horrible, cried another.
We'll all die,
screamed a third, apparently forgetting that he was already dead.
Guys, chill, Frank said. Let Apollo talk.
His leadership style was less formal than Reyna's, but he seemed to command just as much respect. The audience settled, waiting for me to continue. Tarquin is now some sort of undead creature, I said. His tomb is nearby. He was responsible for the attack you repulsed on the new moon.
Which is also a really cruddy time to fight the undead,
Ida volunteered.
And he'll attack again on the Blood Moon, in concert with the Emperor's assault.
I did my best to explain what I'd seen in my dreams, and what Frank and I had discussed with Ella. I did not mention the reference to Frank's unholy piece of firewood, partly because I didn't understand it, partly because Frank was giving me the pleading teddy bear eyes. Since Tarquin was the one who originally purchased the Sibylline books, I summed up, it makes a twisted kind of sense that he would reappear now, when Camp Jupiter is trying to reconstruct those prophecies. Tarquin would be invoked by what Ella is doing.
Enraged, Ella suggested. Infuriated. Homicidal.
Looking at the harpy, I thought of the Cumaean Sibyl and the terrible curse I'd laid upon her. I wondered how Ella might suffer, just because we'd coerced her into entering the prophecy business. Lupa had warned me.
You will face more sacrifices. Death. Blood.
I forced that idea aside. Anyway, Tarquin was monstrous enough when he was alive. The Romans despised him so much they did away with the monarchy forever. Even centuries later, the emperors never dared to call themselves kings. Tarquin died in exile. His tomb was never located. And now it's here, Raina said.
It wasn't a question.
She accepted that an ancient Roman tomb could pop up in Northern California, where it had no business being. The gods moved.
The demigod camps moved.
It was just our luck that an evil undead lair would move in next door. We really needed stricter mythological zoning laws. In the first row next to Hazel, a senator rose to speak. He had dark, curly hair, off-center blue eyes, and a cherry red mustache stain on his upper lip. So to sum up, in 3 days we're facing an invasion from 2 evil emperors, their armies, and 50 ships with weapons we don't understand, along with another wave of undead like the one that nearly destroyed us last time when we were a lot stronger. If that's the bad news, what's the bad news?
I assume we're getting to that, Dakota. Raina turned to me. Right, Lester?
The other bad news, I said, is that I have a plan. But it's going to be hard, maybe impossible, and parts of the plan aren't exactly plan-worthy yet.
Dakota rubbed his hands.
Well, I'm excited. Let's hear it. He sat back down, pulled a flask from his toga, and took a swig.
I guessed that he was a child of Bacchus, and judging from the smell that wafted across the Senate floor, his chosen beverage was fruit punch Kool-Aid.
I took a deep breath. So, the Sibylline books are basically like emergency recipes, right? Sacrifices, ritual prayers. Some are designed to appease angry gods. Some are designed to call for divine aid against your enemies. I believe, I'm pretty sure, if we're able to find the correct recipe for our predicament and do what it says, I may be able to summon help from Mount Olympus.
No one laughed or called me crazy. Gods didn't intervene in demigod affairs often, but it did happen on rare occasions. The idea wasn't completely unbelievable. On the other hand, no one looked terribly assured that I could pull it off. A different senator raised his hand.
It's Senator Larry here, third cohort, son of Mercury. So, when you say help, do you mean like battalions of gods charging down here in their chariots, or more like the gods just giving us their blessing, like, hey, good luck with that, Legion?
My old defensiveness kicked in. I wanted to argue that we gods would never leave our desperate followers hanging like that. But of course we did. All the time.
That's a good question, Senator Larry, I admitted. It would probably be somewhere between those extremes. But I'm confident it would be real help, capable of turning the tide. It may be the only way to save New Rome. And I have to believe Jupiter, set my supposed birthday as April 8th for a reason. It's meant to be a turning point. The day I finally...
My voice cracked. I didn't share the other side of that thought. That April 8th might either be the day I began to prove myself worthy of rejoining the gods, or my last birthday ever. The day I went up in flames once and for all.
More murmuring from the crowd, lots of grave expressions, but I detected no panic. Even the Larrys didn't scream, "We're all going to die." The assembled demigods were Romans, after all. They were used to facing dire predicaments, long odds, and strong enemies.
Okay. Hazel Levesque spoke for the first time. So, how do we find this correct recipe? Where do we start?
I appreciated her confident tone. She might have been asking if she could help with something completely doable, like carrying groceries or impaling ghouls with quartz spikes.
The first step, I said, is to find and explore Tarquin's tomb.
And kill him! Yelled one of the Larrys. No, Marcus Apuleius, scolded one of his peers. Tarquin is as dead as we are.
Well, what then? Grumbled Marcus Apuleius.
Ask him nicely to leave us alone. This is Tarquin the Proud we're talking about. He's a maniac.
The first step, I said, is only to explore the tomb and, find out the right things, as Ella said.
Yep,
the harpy agreed. Ella said that. I have to assume, I continued, that if we succeed in this and come out alive, we will know more about how to proceed. Right now, all I can say with certainty is that the next step will involve finding a soundless god, whatever that means.
Frank sat forward in his praetor's chair. But don't you know all the gods, Apollo? I mean, you are one, or were one. Is there a god of silence?
I sighed. Frank, I can barely keep my own family of gods straight. There are hundreds of minor gods. I don't remember any silent gods. Of course, if there is one, I doubt we would have hung out, me being the god of music. Frank looked crestfallen, which made me feel bad. I hadn't meant to take out my frustrations on one of the few people who still called me Apollo, unironically.
Let's tackle one thing at a time, Raina suggested. First, the Tomb of Tarquin. We have a lead on its location, right, Ella?
Yep, yep.
The harpy closed her eyes and recited,
A wildcat near the spinning lights, the Tomb of Tarquin with horses bright, to open his door, 254.
That is a prophecy, Tyson said. I have it on my back.
The Cyclops stood and ripped off his shirt so fast he must have been waiting for any excuse.
See?
The spectators all leaned forward, though it would have been impossible to read the tattoos from any distance.
I also have a fish pony by my kidney,
he announced proudly.
Isn't it cute?
Hazel averted her eyes as if she might pass out from embarrassment. Tyson, could you... I'm sure it's a lovely fish pony, but shirt back on, please. I don't suppose anyone knows what those lines mean. The Romans observed a moment of silence for the death of clarity that all prophecies symbolized. Lavinia snorted.
Seriously? Nobody gets it?
Lavinia, Raina said. Her voice strained. Are you suggesting you...
know where the tomb is?
Lavinia spread her hands. Well, I mean, a wildcat near the spinning lights, the Tomb of Tarquin with horses bright. There's a wildcat drive in Tilden Park right over the hills. She pointed north. And horses bright, spinning lights? That would be the Tilden Park carousel, wouldn't it?
Oh!
Several Larrys nodded in recognition, as if they spent all their free time riding the local merry-go-rounds. Frank shifted in his chair.
You think the tomb of an evil Roman king is under a carousel?
Hey, I didn't write the prophecy, Lavinia said. Besides, it makes as much sense as anything else we've faced.
Nobody disputed that. Demigods eat weirdness for breakfast, lunch, and dinner.
All right, then, Raina said. We have a goal. We need a quest. A short quest, since time is very limited. We must designate a team of heroes and have them approved by the Senate.
Us,
Meg stood.
Gotta be Lester and me.
I gulped.
She's right, I said, which counted as my heroic act for the day. This is part of my greater quest to regain my place among the gods.
I've brought this trouble to your doorstep. I need to make it right. Please don't anyone try to talk me out of it. I waited desperately, in vain for someone to try to talk me out of it. Hazel Levesque rose.
I'll go too. A centurion is required to lead a quest. If this place is underground, well, that's kind of my specialty.
Her tone also said, I have a score to settle.
Which was fine, except I remembered how Hazel had collapsed that tunnel we'd taken into camp.
I had a sudden, terrifying vision of being crushed under a merry-go-round.
That's 3 questers, then, Raina said. The correct number for a quest. Now, 2.5,
Meg interrupted.
Raina frowned. Sorry? Lester's my servant. We're kind of a team. He shouldn't count as a full quester.
Oh, come on, I protested.
So we can take one more, Meg offered.
Frank sat up. I'd be happy to.
If you didn't have praetor duties to attend to, Raina finished, giving him a look like, you are not leaving me alone, dude. While the questers are out, the rest of us have to prepare the valley's defenses. There's a lot to do.
Right.
Frank slumped.
So, is there anyone else?
Pop! The sound was so loud, half the Larrys disintegrated in alarm. Several senators ducked under their seats. In the back row, Lavinia had a flattened pink gum bubble smeared across her face. She quickly peeled it away and stuck it back in her mouth.
Lavinia, Raina said.
Perfect. Thanks for volunteering.
I call for a Senate vote, Raina said. Do we send Hazel, Lester, Meg, and Lavinia on a quest to find the tomb of Tarquin?
The measure passed unanimously. We were given full Senate approval to find a tomb under a carousel and confront the worst king in Roman history, who also happened to be an undead zombie lord. My day just kept getting better.
Chapter 13. Romance disaster. I'm poison for guys and gals. You want to hang out?
Like chewing gum is a crime.
Lavinia tossed a piece of her sandwich off the roof, where it was immediately snatched up by a seagull. For our picnic lunch, she had brought me, Hazel, and Meg to her favorite thinking place, the rooftop of New Rome University's bell tower, which Lavinia had discovered access to on her own. People were not exactly encouraged to be up here, but it was not strictly forbidden either, which seemed to be the space Lavinia most liked inhabiting. She explained that she enjoyed sitting here because it was directly above the Garden of Faunus, Raina's favorite thinking spot. Raina was not in the garden at present, but whenever she was, Lavinia could look down at the praetor, 100 feet below, and gloat, ha ha, my thinking spot is higher than your thinking spot. Now, as I sat on the precariously slanted red clay tiles, a half-eaten focaccia in my lap, I could see the entire city and valley spread out below us. Everything we stood to lose in the coming invasion. Beyond stretched the flatlands of Oakland and the San Francisco Bay, which in just a few days would be dotted with Caligula's luxury battle yachts.
Honestly,
Lavinia threw another piece of her grilled cheese to the seagulls. If the Legionnaires went for a stupid hike once in a while, they'd know about Wildcat Drive. I nodded, though I suspected that most Legionnaires, who spent a good deal of their time marching in heavy armor, probably wouldn't consider hiking much fun. Lavinia, however, seemed to know every back road, trail, and secret tunnel within 20 miles of Camp Jupiter. I suppose because you never knew when you'd need to sneak out for a date with some pretty hemlock or deadly nightshade. On my other side, Hazel ignored her veggie wrap and grumbled to herself. Can't believe Frank, trying to volunteer. Bad enough after his crazy stunts in the battle. Nearby, having already plowed through her lunch, Meg aided her digestion by doing cartwheels. Every time she landed, catching her balance on the loose tiles, my heart free-climbed a little farther up my throat. Meg, could you please not do that? I asked.
It's fun.
She fixed her eyes on the horizon and announced, I want a unicorn.
Then she cartwheeled again. Lavinia muttered to no one in particular,
"You popped a bubble. You'll be perfect for this quest."
Why do I have to like a guy with a death wish? Hazel mused.
Meg, I pleaded, you're going to fall.
Even a small unicorn, Meg said. Not fair they have so many here and I don't have any.
We continued this four-part disharmony until a giant eagle swooped out of the sky, snatched the rest of the grilled cheese from Lavinia's hand, and soared away, leaving behind a flock of irritated seagulls.
Typical.
Lavinia wiped her fingers on her pants. Can't even have a sandwich. I shoved the rest of the focaccia in my mouth, just in case the eagle came back for seconds.
Well, Hazel sighed. At least we got the afternoon off to make plans.
She gave half of her veggie wrap to Lavinia. Lavinia blinked, apparently unsure how to respond to the kind gesture.
Thanks. But I mean, what is there to plan? We go to the carousel, find the tomb, try not to die.
I swallowed the last of my food, hoping it might push my heart back down to its proper location.
Perhaps we could concentrate on the not dying part. For instance, why wait until tonight? Wouldn't it be safer to go when it's daylight?
It's always dark underground, Hazel said. Besides, during the daytime, lots of kids will be at the carousel. I don't want any of them getting hurt. At night, the place will be deserted.
Meg plopped down next to us. Her hair now looked like a distressed elderberry shrub.
So, Hazel, can you do other cool underground stuff? Some people were saying you can summon diamonds and rubies.
Hazel frowned.
Some people?
Like Lavinia,
Meg said.
Oh my gods, Lavinia said. Thanks a lot, Meg.
Hazel peered into the sky, as if wishing a giant eagle would come and snatch her away.
I can summon precious metals, yes. Riches of the earth.
That's a Pluto thing.
But you can't spend the stuff I summon, Meg.
I leaned back against the roof tiles.
Because it's cursed?
I seem to recall something about a curse. And not because Lavinia told me anything, I added hastily.
Hazel picked at her veggie wrap. It's not so much a curse anymore. In the old days, I couldn't control it. Diamonds, gold coins, stuff like that would just pop up from the ground whenever I got nervous.
Cool,
Meg said. No, it really wasn't, Hazel assured her. If somebody picked up the treasures and tried to spend them, horrible things would happen.
Oh, Meg said.
What about now?
Since I met Frank, Hazel hesitated. A long time ago, Pluto told me that a descendant of Poseidon would wash away my curse.
It's complicated.
But Frank is a descendant of Poseidon on his mom's side.
Once we started dating, he's just a good person, you know? I'm not saying I needed a fella to solve my problems.
A fella?
Meg asked. Hazel's right eye twitched.
Sorry. I grew up in the 1930s. Sometimes my vocab slips. I'm not saying I needed a guy to solve my problems. It's just that Frank had his own curse to deal with, so he understood me. We helped each other through some dark times. Talking together, learning to be happy again. He makes me feel
loved, I suggested. Lavinia met my eyes and mouthed,
adorable.
Hazel tucked her feet underneath her. I don't know why I'm telling you all this. But yes, now I can control my powers a lot better. Jewels don't pop up randomly when I get upset. Still, they're not meant to be spent. I think I have this gut feeling that Pluto wouldn't like that. I don't want to find out what would happen if somebody tried.
Meg pouted,
So you can't give me even a small diamond? Like, just to keep for fun?
Meg, I chided.
Or a ruby.
Meg.
Whatever.
Meg frowned at her unicorn shirt, no doubt thinking how cool it would look decorated with several million dollars worth of precious stones.
I just want to fight stuff.
You'll probably get your wish, Hazel said. But remember, tonight the idea is to explore and gather intel. We'll need to be stealthy.
Yes, Meg, I said, because, if you'll recall, Apollo faces death in Tarquin's tomb.
If I must face death, I would rather do so while hiding in the shadows and then sneak away from it without it ever knowing I was there.
Meg looked exasperated, as if I'd suggested an unfair rule in freeze tag.
Okay, I guess I can stealth.
Good, Hazel said. And Lavinia, no chewing gum.
Give me some credit. I have very sneaky moves.
She wriggled her feet.
Daughter of Terpsichore and all that.
Hazel said. Okay then. Everybody gather your supplies and get some rest. We'll meet on the field of Mars at sundown.
Resting should have been an easy assignment. Meg went off to explore the camp, read See the Unicorns Again, which left me by myself in the cafe's upstairs room. I lay in my cot, enjoying the quiet, staring at Meg's newly planted irises, which were now in full bloom in the window box. Still, I couldn't sleep. My stomach wound throbbed, my head buzzed. I thought of Hazel Levesque and how she'd credited Frank with washing away her curse. Everyone deserved someone who could wash away their curses by making them feel loved. But that was not my fate. Even my greatest romances had caused more curses than they lifted. Daphne, Hyacinthus, and later, yes, the Cumaean Sibyl. I remember the day we had sat together on a beach, the Mediterranean stretching out before us like a sheet of blue glass. Behind us, on the hillside where the Sibyl had her cave, olive trees baked and cicadas droned in the summer heat of southern Italy. In the distance, Mount Vesuvius rose, hazy and purple. Conjuring an image of the Sibyl herself was more difficult. Not the hunched and grizzled old woman from Tarquin's throne room, but the beautiful young woman she'd been on that beach, centuries before, when Cumae was still a Greek colony. I had loved everything about her. The way her hair caught the sunlight, the mischievous gleam in her eyes, the easy way she smiled. She didn't seem to care that I was a god, despite having given up everything to be my oracle, her family, her future, even her name. Once pledged to me, she was known simply as the Sibyl, the voice of Apollo. But that wasn't enough for me. I was smitten. I convinced myself it was love, one true romance that would wash away all my past missteps. I wanted the Sibyl to be my partner throughout eternity. As the afternoon went on, I coaxed and pleaded.
You could be so much more than my priestess, I urged her. Marry me.
She laughed.
You can't be serious.
I am. Ask for anything in return, and it's yours. She twisted a strand of her auburn locks.
All I've ever wanted is to be the Sibyl,
to guide the people of this land to a better future.
You've already given me that, so ha-ha, the joke's on you.
But you've only got one lifetime, I said. If you were immortal, you could guide humans to a better future forever, at my side.
She looked at me askance.
Apollo, please. You'd be tired of me by the end of the week.
Never, So you're saying, she scooped up two heaping handfuls of sand, if I wished for as many years of life as there are grains of this sand, you would grant me that.
It is done, I pronounced.
Instantly, I felt a portion of my own power flowing into her life force. And now, my love.
Whoa, whoa!
She scattered the sand, clambering to her feet and backing away, as if I were suddenly radioactive.
That was a hypothetical, lover boy. I didn't agree.
What's done is done, I rose. A wish cannot be taken back. Now you must honor your side of the bargain.
Her eyes danced with panic.
I can't. I won't.
I laughed, thinking she was merely nervous. I spread my arms. Don't be afraid.
Of course I'm afraid.
She backed away farther.
Nothing good ever happens to your lovers. I just wanted to be your Sybil. And now you've made things weird.
My smile crumbled. I felt my ardor cooling, turning stormy. Don't anger me, Sybil. I am offering you the universe. I've given you near immortal life. You cannot refuse payment.
Payment?
She balled her hands into fists.
You dare think of me as a transaction?
I frowned.
This afternoon really wasn't going the way I'd planned. I didn't mean... Obviously, I wasn't.
Well, Lord Apollo,
she growled.
If this is a transaction, then I defer payment until your side of the bargain is complete. You said it yourself. Near immortal life.
I'll live until the grains of sand run out, yes?
Come back to me at the end of that time.
Then if you still want me, I'm yours. I dropped my arms. Suddenly, all the things I'd loved about the Sybil became things I hated. Her headstrong attitude, her lack of awe, her infuriating, unattainable beauty. Especially her beauty. Very well. My voice turned colder than any sun god should be. You want to argue over the fine print of our contract? I promised you life, not youth. You can have your centuries of existence. You will remain my Sybil. I cannot take those things away once given. But you will grow old. You will wither. You will not be able to die.
I would prefer that.
Her words were defiant, but her voice trembled with fear.
Fine,
I snapped.
Fine,
she yelled back. I vanished in a column of flame, having succeeded in making things very weird indeed. Over the centuries, the Sybil had withered, just as I'd threatened. Her physical form lasted longer than any ordinary mortal's, but the pain I had caused her, the lingering agony. Even if I'd had regrets about my hasty curse, I couldn't have taken it back any more than she could take back her wish. Finally, around the end of the Roman Empire, I'd heard rumors that the Sybil's body had crumbled away entirely, yet still she could not die. Her attendants kept her life force, the faintest whisper of her voice in a glass jar. I assumed that the jar had been lost sometime after that, that the Sybil's grains of sand had finally run out. But what if I was wrong? If she were still alive, I doubted she was using her faint whisper of a voice to be a pro-Apollo social media influencer. I deserved her hatred. I saw that now. Oh, Jason Grace. I promised you I would remember what it was to be human. But why did human shame have to hurt so much? Why wasn't there an off button? And thinking of the Sybil, I couldn't help considering that other young woman with a curse.
Reina Avila Ramirez Arellano. I'd been completely blindsided the day I strolled into the Olympian throne room, fashionably late for our meeting as usual, and found Venus studying the luminous image of a young lady floating above her palm. The goddess's expression had been weary and troubled, something I didn't often see.
"Who's that?" I asked foolishly. "She's beautiful."
That's all the trigger Venus needed to unleash her fury. She told me Reina's fate. No demigod would ever be able to heal her heart. But that did not mean I was the answer to Reina's problem. Quite the contrary. In front of the entire assembly of gods, Venus announced that I was unworthy. I was a disaster. I had ruined every relationship I was in, and I should keep my godly face away from Reina, or Venus would curse me with even worse romantic luck than I already had. The mocking laughter of the other gods still rang in my ears. If not for that encounter, I might never have known Reina existed. I certainly had no designs on her, but we always want what we cannot have. Once Venus declared Reina off limits, I became fascinated with her. Why had Venus been so emphatic? What did Reina's fate mean? Now I thought I understood. As Lester Papadopoulos, I no longer had a godly face. I was neither mortal, nor god, nor demigod. Had Venus somehow known this would happen someday? Had she shown me Reina and warned me off, knowing full well that it would make me obsessed? Venus was a wily goddess. She played games within games. If it was my fate to be Reina's true love, to wash away her curse as Frank had done for Hazel, would Venus allow it? But at the same time, I was a romantic disaster. I had ruined every one of my relationships, brought nothing but destruction and misery to the young men and women I'd loved. How could I believe I would be any good for the Praetor? I lay in my cot, these thoughts tossing around in my mind until late afternoon. Finally, I gave up on the idea of rest. I gathered my supplies, my quiver and bow, my ukulele and my backpack, and I headed out. I needed guidance, and I could think of only one way to get it.
Chapter 14. Reluctant arrow, grant me this boon, permission, to Skedaddleth. I had the field of Mars all to myself. Since no war games were scheduled that evening, I could frolic through the wasteland to my heart's content, admiring the wreckage of chariots, broken battlements, smoldering pits, and trenches filled with sharpened spikes. Another romantic sunset stroll wasted because I had no one to share it with. I climbed an old siege tower and sat facing the northern hills. With a deep breath, I reached into my quiver and pulled out the Arrow of Dodona. I'd gone several days without talking to my annoying, far-sighted projectile weapon, which I considered a victory. But now, gods help me, I could think of no one else to turn to. "I need help," I told it. The arrow remained silent, perhaps stunned by my admission. Or perhaps I'd pulled out the wrong arrow and I was talking to an inanimate object. Finally, the shaft rattled in my hand. Its voice resonated in my mind like a thespian tuning fork.
"Thy words are true, but in what sense meanest thou?"
Its tone sounded less derisive than usual. That scared me. I am supposed to show strength," I said. "According to Lupa, I'm supposed to save the day somehow, or the pack, New Rome, will die. But how do I do that?" I told the arrow all that had happened in the last few days. My encounter with the Uranomoi, my dreams about the Emperors and Tarquin, my conversation with Lupa, our quest from the Roman Senate, To my surprise, it felt good to pour out my troubles. Considering the arrow didn't have ears, it was a good listener. It never looked bored, shocked, or disgusted, because it had no face. I crossed the Tiber alive, I summed up, just like the prophecy said. Now, how do I start to jive? Does this mortal body have a reset switch? The arrow buzzed.
I shall think upon this.
That's it. No advice? No snarky comments?
Give me time to consider, oh impatient Lester.
But I don't have time. We're leaving for Tarquin's tomb like... I glanced to the west, where the sun was beginning to sink behind the hills. Basically now.
The journey into the tomb will not be thy final challenge, unless thou suckest most woefully.
Is that supposed to make me feel better?
Fight not the king, said the arrow. Hearest thou what thou needest, and skedaddleth?
Did you just use the term skedaddleth?
I try to speak plainly to thee, to grant thee a boon, and still thou complainest.
I appreciate a good boon as much as the next person, but if I'm going to contribute to this quest and not just cower in the corner, I need to know how. My voice cracked. How to be me again? The vibration of the arrow felt almost like a cat purring, trying to soothe an ill human.
Art thou sure that is thy wish?
What do you mean? I demanded. That's the whole point. Everything I'm doing is so...
Are ye talking to that arrow? Said a voice below me.
At the base of the siege tower stood Frank Zhang. Next to him was Hannibal the elephant, impatiently pawing the mud. I'd been so distracted, I'd let an elephant get the drop on me. Hi, I squeaked, my voice still ragged with emotion. I was just... This arrow gives prophetic advice. It talks in my head. Bless him. Frank managed to maintain a poker face.
Okay, I can leave if...
No, no. I slipped the arrow back in my quiver. It needs time to process. What brings you out here?
Walking the elephant.
Frank pointed to Hannibal, in case I might be wondering which elephant.
He gets stir-crazy when we don't have war games. Bobby used to be our elephant handler, but...
Frank shrugged helplessly. I got his meaning. Bobby had been another casualty of the battle. Killed, or maybe worse. Hannibal grunted deep in his chest. He wrapped his trunk around a broken battering ram, picked it up, and started pounding it into the ground like a pestle. I remembered my elephant friend Livia back at the way station in Indianapolis. She too had been grief-stricken, having lost her mate to Commodus's brutal games. If we survived this upcoming battle, perhaps I should try to introduce Livia and Hannibal. They'd make a cute couple. I mentally slapped myself. What was I thinking? I had enough to worry about without playing matchmaker to pachyderms. I climbed down from my perch, careful to protect my bandaged gut. Frank studied me, perhaps worried by how stiffly I was moving.
You ready for your quest? He asked.
Is the answer to that question ever yes?
Good point.
And what will you do while we're gone? Frank ran a hand across his buzz cut.
Everything we can. Shore up the valley's defenses. Keep Ella and Tyson working on the Sibylline books. Send eagles to scout the coast. Keep the Legion drilling so they don't have time to worry about what's coming. Mostly, though, it's about being with the troops, assuring them that everything is going to be okay.
Lying to them, in other words, I thought, though that was bitter and uncharitable. Hannibal stuck his battering ram upright in a sinkhole.
He patted the old tree trunk as if to say, "There you go, little fella. Now you can start growing again." Even the elephant was hopelessly optimistic. "I don't know how you do it," I admitted, staying positive after all that's happened. Frank kicked a piece of stone. "What's the alternative?" "A nervous breakdown?" I suggested. "Running away? But I'm new to this being mortal business."
"Yeah, well, I can't say those ideas haven't crossed my mind. But you can't really do that when you're a praetor."
He frowned.
"Though I'm worried about Reyna. She's been carrying the burden a lot longer than I have. Years longer. The strain of that, I don't know. I just wish I could help her more."
I recalled Venus's warning. "You will not stick your ugly, unworthy, godly face anywhere near her." I wasn't sure which idea was more terrifying, that I might make Reyna's life worse, or that I might be responsible for making her life better. Frank apparently misinterpreted my look of concern.
"Hey, you'll be fine. Hazel will keep you safe. She's one powerful demigod."
I nodded, trying to swallow the bitter taste in my mouth. I was tired of others keeping me safe. The whole point of consulting the Arrow had been to figure out how I could get back to the business of keeping others safe. That used to be so easy with my godlike powers. "Was it, though?" another part of my brain asked. "Did you keep the Sibyl safe? Or Hyacinthus? Or Daphne? Or your..."